I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. In this week when Jews celebrate Passover and Christians celebrate Easter, it's another installment of Living Questions, our monthly series in which we explore the role of religion in the public sphere. Today, the thorny issue of anti-Judaism in some of the great works of Christian art, with two writers for whom J.S. Bach is a central focus. Lauren Belfer is a novelist. Her latest book follows the journey of a Bach cantata as it changes hands over the course of 200 years. Music scholar Michael Morrison has written extensively about the religious and often anti-Jewish sentiments in the texts that Bach chooses to set to his glorious music. His latest book is called Bach and God, Confronting the Legacy of Anti-Semitism in the Arts. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, our monthly series on the role of religion in the public sphere, Living Questions. We produce this series in conjunction with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. And today, in the season of Passover and Easter, I thought it would be good to take up a subject that I've had a particular interest in since the early 1990s. The subject is the charge of deicide, or killing God, that's been leveled against Jews since the early days of the Common Era. I came to this subject through my work as a musician when I conducted big oratorios by Johann Sebastian Bach, in which he tells the story of the passion and death of Jesus according to both the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of John. Each of these Gospels takes up the issue of who's responsible for Jesus' death in very different ways, but the Jews in Jerusalem and the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, play significant roles in both tellings. The question I came to ask myself is this: do these Gospels perpetuate the narrative that the Jews killed Jesus? And if they do, then what happens when that narrative is told musically by a composer as brilliant as Bach? So if the message of the Gospels is, in fact, anti-Jewish, is the music of Bach also anti-Jewish? And if people like me perform this music for the public, am I anti-Jewish? The answers to those questions can be informed by what we understand about the first century Palestine of Jesus, the 18th century Germany of Bach, and our own 21st century world. It's a timely topic as well. Incidents of hate crimes throughout the United States that are based on religious bigotry spiked immediately after the election of Donald Trump last November. Hundreds of anti-Semitic incidents involving desecrations of Jewish cemeteries and synagogues, spray-painted swastikas and the like have been reported. So to help us explore this today, my guests are Lauren Belfer and Michael Morrison. They are husband and wife, they are writers, and they have each placed anti-Judaism and the music of Bach at the center of their latest work. Lauren Belfer has written a wonderful novel that takes the reader from 18th century Prussia through World War II Germany and contemporary New York. It's called And After the Fire. Michael Morrison is a musicologist who specializes in the music of Bach and who was the first scholar to bring this issue to public attention in books and in articles in the New York Times and elsewhere. His latest book is a collection of essays around this topic. It's called Bach and God. Lauren Belfer and Michael Morrison join us from the Argo Studios in New York. Welcome to Midday. Glad to have you.
Great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Likewise.
So, Lauren, let's start with you. I really loved this novel, And After the Fire. Introduce us to a couple of characters. The first is one that you imagined. Her name is Susanna Kessler. Tell us about her.
Well, you know, I got the idea to do this book several years ago when I received in the mail an announcement for an adult education class about the music of Bach. And even though I knew virtually nothing about Bach, I had a feeling that I ought to sign up and take this class, that somehow it would turn out to be important to me. And it did, because that's where I met Michael, who's now my husband.
How convenient.
yes, very. But I was really surprised by what I learned in the class, that Bach's music turned out to be more transcendently beautiful than I had ever imagined possible. But some of the sacred music, not all of it, but some of it, turned out to carry a prejudicial message, not just against Jews, but also against Catholics, against Muslims, sometimes against the Protestants who lived in the next town and were not Lutherans. And, you know, I realized that these feelings were part and parcel of Bach's world. But the question to me really was, what do we do in our world when these works are performed in our world? And that's what led me to create the character of Susanna Kessler living today, and she inherits a Bach cantata that turns out to have an anti-Semitic libretto. And the questions that I was asking then became her questions and her search in the novel to discover the history of this cantata.
And we follow the journey that this cantata has once it gets into Susanna's possession, but also well before that. There's another character who is an historical figure, a real figure. Her name is Sarah Levy or Sarah Levy. How do you pronounce her last name?
I've always said Sarah Levy. Mm-hmm. Yes, and you know, once I decided that I would examine, you know, a fictional cantata, I went back in time to develop a provenance or a history for this work of art. And first I read about Bach, and then I read about his sons. And then I was reading about Bach's eldest son, Wilhelm Friedemann, I learned that toward the end of his life, really as a professional failure, he washed up in Berlin and began teaching the harpsichord to the daughter of one of the wealthiest Jews in Germany, Daniel Itzig, who worked as Frederick the Great's banker. And this young woman was named Sarah Itzig, and she was extremely gifted. And I suddenly felt a kind of affinity with her, and I decided that she would be the one to inherit my fictional cantata from her teacher, Wilhelm Friedemann, and that I would follow her family through what became, you know, 200 years of German history. I really lucked out in landing on Sarah Itzig Levy, because it turned out that she is the great aunt of the composers Fanny and Felix Mendelssohn. So the book, you know, her story led me to explore things I hadn't really thought about when I first designed the book, and being able to, you know, really portray an entire society beyond the issue of anti-Semitism in the masterpiece, but, you know, to use this masterpiece as a kind of filter for showing 200 years of German history.
Lauren Belfer, her new novel is called And After the Fire. We turn now to Lauren's husband, my good friend Michael Morrison. Michael, before we begin, full disclosure, you and I, along with Christopher Layton, who at the time was the executive director of the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies, which is now called the Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies, wrote a monograph about this subject called Contending with the Legacy of Anti-Semitism, the Bach Passions in Our Time. It's published on the ICJS website, and we'll have a link to that. And you wrote a seminal work about this back in 1998, and a few years before that, in 1991, when I was the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, we gave a performance of the St. Matthew Passion, and we had, in conjunction with that performance, a symposium that had a visual arts scholar, a musical scholar, who is actually your teacher, a wonderful guy named Eric Chafe, and a biblical scholar, and we talked about all of these issues, and you've written extensively about it. You are the world's leading expert on this. In a general sense, how do we know? How can we determine what Bach means in a particular piece of music? How do we know what's going on in his brain when we hear his beautiful music?
Well, I don't think we really know what's going on in Bach's brain. Although I don't think there's any reason to doubt that it went on in his brain was similar to what goes on in the music. But I would say our focus by necessity, and it's okay that it's that way, needs to be focused just on the repertory itself. I mean, it's always theoretically possible that he was an extremely modern, liberal, and ecumenical, but he felt compelled to be conservative, somewhat polemical figure because he needed to pay the rent, and that's what the authorities in Leipzig wanted. I mean, it sounds a little ridiculous when you put it that way. But as I say, that's theoretically possible, but I would say it's unlikely. Part of the problem is it's hard to recognize some of the of this stuff in Bach because it requires a knowledge of the Bible that most people don't have nowadays. So to use a really simple example, a cantata like number 44 by Bach is called Sie werden euch in den Bann tun. They will place you under the ban. Most Bach lovers have no idea what that's about or where that comes from, and they don't realize that that's a direct quotation of Luther's translation of the Gospel of John, chapter 16, where it says, they will place you who believe in Jesus as the Messiah, they will kick you out of the community, and a time is coming very soon when they will kill you and think that they are doing God a service thereby. And all of that is set to magnificent, menacing music by Bach.
Yeah, so it's a complete slam on the Jewish people writ large, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly. And then it goes on then to say that not only are they, premised on the idea that earlier in the gospel, Jesus is depicted as saying to the Jews that they are by nature and volition murderers and liars. And so the idea is that not only will they lie about Jesus and get him killed, but they will lie about you and get you killed eventually too. And then what the cantatas go on to do is to say that you can also apply that whenever anyone persecutes you. That is to say, for example, if the Roman Catholic Church persecutes Lutherans, then they are in effect metaphorical or rhetorical Jews. They are the sort of fulfillment of that prophecy in the gospel. And as I say, that's hard to. Most people don't know about that because they don't have the requisite background. And I've been this unpleasant person who come along and points this all out.
Right. And Lauren, Susanna struggles with this very issue in your novel, in that she's in possession of this thing that is virulently anti-Jewish. And one impulse, of course, is to say, well, this should never be played. I mean, there's a lot of people who think that the cantata that Michael just alluded to, or the St. John Passion or the St. Matthew Passion, because of the heated rhetoric in the Gospels, should simply not be played. It should be taken out of the repertory. So Susanna struggles with this notion of what's the right thing to do with this artifact, this document. How does she calculate an answer to that question of what to do?
Well, I think for her, because this is a novel, her decision is very personal and emotional. She comes from a family that lost many members during the war. So it touches very close to her and mirrors my own experiences. I think the reason that I couldn't let this go is the same as Susanna couldn't, because when these issues do touch so closely, when you've lost members of your own family in the war, it suddenly becomes very personal rather than very far away. And I must say, I struggled as the writer along with Susanna, and I wrote several different endings for the book before settling on the one that's there now. And I don't want to reveal what Susanna finally decides.
We're not going to tell what that is, yeah.
But, certainly she struggled even with whether to destroy the cantata. And I think Sarah Itzig struggled with whether to destroy it. But it's a masterpiece of art. And how do you destroy a great masterpiece of art? I don't think there are any easy answers to these questions. And, when I talk to people at book events, I find that many people struggle with these very issues. Should they go to, hear performances of Wagner when Wagner wrote anti-Semitic writings? It's a very important question for people. And I think, each individual has to choose for him or herself. I myself don't go to hear Wagner's operas, but that I would not presume to judge what anyone else should do.
And Michael Morrison, before we take a break, we should note that, Bach was writing this glorious art, but he also had a purpose. He was the minister of music at the St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, Germany and the minister of music at another church at the same time, actually, in the same town. And he had an agenda, didn't he? When he was writing his music, his agenda was to preach. So then it's a matter of, you know, what was he preaching and what was that preaching based on?
Right. Well, these were not designed to be concert pieces, although they work spectacularly well as concert pieces. So what I often say nowadays is that I'm not an advocate of changing the text or not performing them in concert. I think it's just good to have some contextual information made available to people. And then, as Lauren says, they can decide themselves how they what they would like to do or how they would like to feel. But I do, maybe not everyone would agree with me on this, but I do think if you do nowadays perform them in a church service as part of the liturgy, then I think you are obligated to make some textual changes here and there, because the function in a church service is to have the music be proclaiming what the community believes is important. And most communities nowadays don't want to be communicating those things.
The musicologist Michael Morrison, his latest collection of essays is entitled Bach and God. The novelist Lauren Belfer, his wife, joins us as well. Her latest book is called And After the Fire. They join us from New York. We'll have more on religious intolerance and the music of Bach when we come back from a break here on Midday. Our number 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join our conversation. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stick around, we will be back soon.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Music of Johann Sebastian Bach, the beautiful aria Mache dich mein Herzerein. Of course, Bach writes in his native German, it means make yourself pure, my heart. It comes towards the end of Bach's sweeping oratorio, the St. Matthew Passion. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking today about the music of Bach and the difficult fact that in his music, Bach sometimes sets texts that are anti-Jewish. So as beautiful and soaring as his music is, the message of that music is sometimes very difficult to hear for anyone who values tolerance and respect for religious diversity. This particular aria isn't an example of anti-Judaism in the music of Bach, but examples do abound, and in his latest collection of essays called Bach and God, the musicologist Michael Morrison offers several examples, and he explains how we should confront and understand this music. Michael Morrison joins us on the line from New York, along with his wife, the novelist Lauren Belfer. The music of Bach is central to her latest novel, a wonderful, sweeping historical novel that combines historical figures and figures that she has invented. It's called And After the Fire. It's Living Questions here on Midday, in which we explore the role of religion in the public sphere. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our number at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Lauren, let me ask you to talk a little bit about the title of your novel, And After the Fire. It actually comes from an oratorio of one of the historical characters that's in the book, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. It's from the Bible, from the Book of Kings, which is the story of Elijah. And Felix Mendelssohn, who appears in the novel, wrote an oratorio called Elijah. And for reasons we don't know, when Felix died, his brother-in-law, who was an artist, did a death portrait of Felix that was commonly done in those times. But as I say, for reasons we don't know, the brother-in-law wrote these lines from Elijah onto the death portrait. And I found that very touching because the phrase "and after the fire" resonated with me for a different reason. The original meaning of the word Holocaust is a consuming fire. And in the contemporary sections of my novel, all of the characters, whether they're Christians or Jews, whether they're Americans or Germans, they're all trying to reconcile themselves to the world after the war, reconcile themselves to what happened during the war, to try to understand it, whether they were victims or perpetrators. So the idea of the world after the fire was always at the forefront of my mind as I was working on the novel. And so I decided to use that as the title.
Yeah. And Michael, Lauren's novel reminds us that the Holocaust didn't come out of nowhere, you know? I mean, the arts have for many, many generations played a big part in perpetuating this notion that the Jews killed Jesus, that they are guilty of deicide, and because of that, anything that happens, any bad things that happen to the Jews as a people are justified. I mean, Martin Luther himself, some years, 26 years after the famous 95 Theses on the church in Wittenberg, wrote a thing called another screed, a 60,000 word document called "On the Jews and Their Lies," a virulent document, anti-Jewish document. And we have to face the fact that J.S. Bach, as the minister of music at a Lutheran church in the 1700s, was very, very influenced in his theological approach by Martin Luther, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, that's right. And it might be worth pointing out, because I think it might not be known to a lot of people, that the title of Luther's treatise on the Jews and their lies, he got that idea, of course, from John 8, because where, as I mentioned before, where Jews are called liars by nature.
Jesus himself calling Jews liars and saying they're from the devil.
That's
in the
right.
43rd and 44th verse of chapter 8 in the Gospel of John, right?
And in light of all of that, it's sort of interesting that although some of the church cantatas of Bach, as I alluded to before, are quite nasty, and others of them actually talk about the murderousness of the Muslim and the Catholic too. So he's willing to offend a series of groups. What's interesting about the Passion settings, though, is that I like to compare them to Passions by other composers. And I think it's fair to make the generalization that most Passion settings are not as ferocious as Bach's in setting the biblical story itself, where the Jews are depicted as calling for Jesus' death and so on. So he's harsher in that respect. But it's balanced in the other direction by, since most of these Passion settings consist of commentary on the Passion narrative via those beautiful arias and chorales and so on that you were performing or that you were playing earlier on the show, the arias and chorales that comment on the story, they go in the other direction and focus on the sinfulness of the contemporary Lutheran and don't engage the issue at all of Jewish responsibility for the death of Jesus. And Bach is unusual in that respect. So it sounds like I'm contradicting myself a little bit here, but I'm not actually. As it happens, Bach was one of the few composers who was following Luther's unheeded advice that there's basically a time and a place for anti-Judaism in the liturgy. And Luther didn't think that the Passion Week was the best time for it. There he thought you should really focus on the sinfulness of the Lutheran. And there are other times in the church year, like where that Cantata 44 was from, that would be appropriate to do that. So Bach's commentary is much less problematic, and his setting of the story is much more problematic. And so it has a way of, if you're paying attention, and there's something to make virtually everyone really uncomfortable one way or the other. They're very challenging works in that respect.
And Lauren, in your novel, one of the characters notes a true historical fact that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America didn't repudiate Luther's screed on the Jews and their lies until 1994. This is a recent development in the Evangelical Lutheran Church. And of course, there are various factions of the Lutheran
right.
Church. I wonder, you know, what's been your reaction to the big spike, not only in the city of New York, but in California, Texas, Florida, and other places, desecrations of Jewish cemeteries, swastikas painted on synagogues. You know, there has been a spike in anti-Jewish violence since the November election.
Well, you know, of course, it's very upsetting, very distressing. In certain ways, reminds me of Germany in the 1930s. I suppose these feelings have always been with us. And in the novel, I was very surprised as I read letters and diaries of, you know, my real life historical characters. You know, the time that I'm writing about, around 1800 in Prussia, was a time when, on the surface at least, there seemed to be a tremendous alliance between Christians and Jews, that wealthy Jewish women organized artistic salons where Christians and Jews mingled freely. But then when I read the letters of some of the Christians who attended these salons, they would write, you know, often every day to their family members in the country and express really terrible prejudicial comments about the people whose hospitality they enjoyed every day. So it taught me that there's been this kind of terrible element eating away at Western culture. Well, you know, how far back do we want to go? You know, I'm not a scholar of this. I can only report what it is that I've read in letters, in diaries, what people are actually saying as they lead their lives from day to day.
Well, you may not be a credentialed scholar, but I will say that this book is assiduously researched, and I'm sure you did some of your research by yelling across your apartment and saying, "Hey, Michael, what about this?" Right? Because
well,
it's very musically erudite, too.
That's true. And one thing I have to say, Michael really kept me on the straight and narrow when it came to factual, when it came to the facts that I was using.
It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it, right, Michael? Lauren Belfer, her new novel is called And After the Fire. She joins us with her husband, Michael Morrison. His new collection of essays is called Bach and God. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Mike in Rosedale, welcome to Midday with Michael Morrison and Lauren Belfer.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. I'm an American who happens to be black and a Christian by choice. And one thing that I have always been baffled by as far as anti-Semitism is concerned is that anti-Semites fail to realize three things. Number one, Jesus was a Jew. Number two, Jews didn't kill Christ. Romans killed Christ. And number three, if you're a true Christian, you're a true follower of Christ, then why don't you follow what he said from the cross, which is, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I'd appreciate those you thinking about that and then comment on it. Let me know what you think.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. You've raised really great questions. And Michael Morrison, you've thought about this a lot. I've thought about this a lot. And, of course, one of the challenges we have is that different gospels portray Jesus in very different postures towards the Jews and the culpability. Where do you come down on Mike's excellent questions?
Those are indeed very good questions. Central. And I don't want to get too technical here, but that wonderful comment that about Father, forgive them for they know not what they do is in the Gospel of Luke, his passion narrative, which is very different from John's version. And in fact, as a verse itself, it's even contested whether it was in the original version of it or not, but we don't need to get sidetracked with that. But as you said, the it's really only the Gospel of John of the four Gospels that harps on the Jews over and over again. They're mentioned about 70 times in that Gospel, whereas that phrase appears only once in the Gospel of Matthew. So part of it is that there are different takes on what's actually going on. And as to the question that Jesus himself is a Jew and that is and implied and that is that his followers are Jews, the Gospel of John is very keen to make a very strong distinction between people who don't believe in Jesus as the Messiah from Judea and people from Judea who do believe that he's the Messiah. And they consistently, this isn't often noticed, they consistently refer in the Gospel of John to non-believers in Jesus as the Messiah as Jews, and those who do believe in him as disciples or brothers and that sort of thing. But no active follower of Jesus is ever called a Jew in the Gospel of John. It's designed to set up that kind of dichotomy in the same way that that gospel is focused on dichotomies like above and below and light and darkness and belief and unbelief and so on and so forth. So that... And then there's this tricky thing. There were a lot of Germanic scholars in the 19th century, for example, and especially in the 20th century, who argued that Jesus, in fact, was not ethnically Jewish. He was from Galilee, which is a different ethnic group. And they were very keen to say that some early Judaic followers of Jesus had misrepresented who he was and that, you know, he's really an Aryan, honestly, you know. So there are a lot of interesting historical issues around that, but I think the main sort of religious point is true that if you take very seriously the idea that you should love others, and which is not a big message in the issue of love in the Gospel of John is focused for fellow believers, but the other Gospels are very big on loving your neighbor. And if you truly loved your neighbor, you wouldn't be anti-Jewish.
And again, as you mentioned, Bach does kind of go out of his way to stress the responsibility for the death of Jesus on the individual sinner rather than the Jews, and he does that in the commentary. Abby in Towson, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a very interesting program. Part of it has made my blood boil, I guess, the part about people still thinking that Jews killed Jesus. Well, on the flip side, my uncle, he was a rabbi, but his name was Mark Tannenbaum, and he did a lot of work in bringing different religious groups together. He was a pioneer in this, and one of his life goals was to say that the Jews did not kill Jesus. So I try to live my life every day being kind to people, no matter what their background is, and that's pretty much all that I have to comment on.
Well, thank you for your call, Abby, and happy Passover. I appreciate your call. This is a very difficult issue for Jews and Christians both, in that when people like the Baltimore Choral Arts Society or the Baltimore Symphony or whomever might decide to perform the St. Matthew Passion or the St. John Passion, it just raises tremendous, tremendous thorny problems. I mean, we tried to solve it, if you will, or at least tried to address it by saying, okay, we're going to do this piece, but we're going to use the piece, we're going to use the occasion of our performance as an opportunity to talk about these difficult issues. And Lauren, in the book, you also talk a lot about the valuation of art, and you have these scholars, you know, advising Susanna as to what she might do with this treasure, this heretofore unknown cantata by Bach. You know, there are people who say, well, beauty matters, but there are things that matter more, and it's a real struggle for Susanna and for many people in the book, is it not?
Well, yes, it is, and I tried in the book to create in the contemporary sections, you know, fictional characters who were both Jews and Christians, and portray both sides sympathetically, and I found that, you know, you really can't put a price onto a masterpiece of art, and yet, you know, prices are put on it every day at auctions. But for myself, I found that I couldn't look at this work, this fictional work of art, or the actual works that Michael studies, simply as aesthetic objects. Sometimes when I go out and talk to readers around the country, people will say to me, well, just ignore what the words say. The words don't matter. And Bach didn't write the words anyway, so what does it matter? Just listen to the beauty. And I found that that is a kind of a branch of musical scholarship that says, you know, we just appreciate the aesthetic glories. And, you know, people can make that decision if that's simply the way they want to receive the work, simply as a work of beauty. You know, that's their decision. But it seems to me that context is really important and that we should seek out the context. Bach did not write these librettos, but he was responsible as part of his job for choosing the librettos that he used. So to me, the music and the words are intrinsically linked, and we do have to address both of them. So these issues are very complex, as you say, and each individual has to decide where he or she comes down on it. I will say that as I've traveled the country doing events, many Lutherans do come to my events. And, you know, at first I was a little nervous as to what the reaction would be to the novel. But so many people have come up to me and said, thank you for bringing up these issues. Thank you for providing a forum where we can discuss these things and for showing parts of our heritage that, you know, that aren't taught, that aren't faced, but that people feel are important, that people want to know about and want to talk about.
Well, that, unfortunately, is all the time we have in our forum today, but I want to thank both of you and congratulate you on these terrific books. Really, really appreciate it. And happy Easter to you, Michael. Happy Passover to you, Lauren. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Lauren Belfer, her latest novel, is out in paperback early next month. It's called And After the Fire. It's published by HarperCollins. By the way, it won the inaugural Book Club Award in the National Jewish Book Awards. Michael Morrison's latest book is a collection of essays called Bach and God. It's published by Oxford University Press. And we've got a link to more information about both books on our website, wypr.org/midday. This has been another installment of Living Questions, our series on religion in the public sphere. We produce this series in cooperation with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Come to wypr.org/livingquestions for an archive of all of the conversations in the series. We'll also have a link to the monograph that Michael Morrison, Christopher Layton, and I wrote called The Bach Passions in Our Time, Contending with the Legacy of Antisemitism. By the way, coming up tomorrow here on Midday, State Senator Jim Rosapep joins me to talk about some of the legislation that passed in the Maryland General Assembly having to do with protecting Maryland from laws that the Trump administration may pass, things like Planned Parenthood, the Chesapeake Bay, Meals on Wheels, and even Wall Street reform were taken up in the session that ended on Monday night. We'll talk to Senator Rosapep about that package of legislation. And as we do every Friday, we'll have the Midday News Wrap. My guest tomorrow will be the economist and author Dr. Julianne Malveaux and Diedrich Asante Mohammed from the Corporation for Economic Development. That's a nonprofit think tank that studies racial disparities. That's the Midday News Wrap coming your way tomorrow at noon. Coming up after a quick break today, our weekly theater review with Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick. I'm Tom Hall. Back in a flash. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.